Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are hearing a keynote address mainly to scientists and experts in Australia. It was in July with the same disturbing assessment John Schellenhuber has given directly to many heads of government. Back to this talk by Professor Schellenhuber of the Potsdam Institute from the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia.
Here, this is a famous work by Ove, who is here at the conference, just tells you that the oceans, in particular the tropical oceans, will find themselves squeezed in between warming, so with all the coral bleaching and so on, and acidification. And this morning I read a top-level intellectual newspaper, The Australian, here at breakfast. And I found a heartbreaking story about tourist companies operating at the Great Barrier Reef who complain about the carbon tax, that the diesel for shipping tourists to these wonderful, pristine places will increase in price. So the tourist industry will face collapse, but the collapse of the Great Barrier Reef as such doesn't seem to be a risk for them. And if you want to have a metaphor for the short-sightedness of people, you can find it in this fine newspaper here. By the way, interesting, I'm very much in general interested in non-linearities in the system, threshold behavior, tipping points, and so on. What you find here, for example, for the United States, a recent work in Proceedings of the National Academy, 2009, tells you that, yes, and that is a sort of common pattern we found also in the IPCC, that for agricultural productivity in general, you have an increase up to 2 or 3 degrees warming, so to speak, and then you have a sharp decline if you go beyond that threshold. And that is, for example, here true. For the United States, you have a fairly mild increase in productivity for certain crops, but then dramatically the productivity goes down. Now, this is very bad news because human beings in general and in industries always try to sort of, explore opportunities until you enter a point of no return. That is precisely why we need scientific evidence here. And here is some work I just wanted to cite because Tony McMichael, a friend of mine who is also here, I invited him at that time to write a commentary on that. This is now, if you like, the worst case scenario. What I've shown you, 8 degrees warming or even more. What would it mean for the very survival of human beings as physiological entities? And this was a study done by medical researchers who just showed if the world would warm up in certain regions at least by 11 or 12 degrees, simply our physical subsistence would cease because we could not sweat enough in order to keep body temperature around 37 degrees. It would be absolutely impossible. So you would have to leave those regions. So 9 billion people sitting all in Canada or Sweden could become very uncomfortable. So, tipping points, I will not dwell a lot on that. So that was a scheme. Actually, I introduced at a lecture at Oxford when I gave the Lineker lecture in 2001 in Oxford. I presented for the first time this type of map. Where are the system elements of the planetary machinery which can be switched into a different mode of operation by global warming, like destabilization of monsoon systems, deflection or shutdown of ocean currents like the North Atlantic thermaline oscillation, things like that. Of course, biome shifts, El Nino, Southern Oscillation, ice sheets, and so on. And very quickly, this was, I was invited by PNAS to do a special feature on that, so we collected some 10 papers on that, on tipping dynamics on Earth. Now, this is recent work by Potsdam Institute showing that with an additional warming between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees, so that is clearly the theme of the conference, there will be the beginning of the meltdown of the Greenland ice sheet. So if only for this very reason, the adoption of a 2 degrees target would make a lot of sense for the world. Huh? Because, you know, meltdown of Greenland over the long run means 7 meters sea level rise alone. The story is much more complicated if you go to, and Dave Griggs knows about that, who is in the room, if you go to biomes, that is the Amazon rainforest, where the Hadley Center model was predicting more or less a collapse of parts of it with global warming. Other models show less dramatic effects. But you see, if you have a cloud of predictions here, most of them point in the direction from rainforest to savanna. That is what science at best can tell you. It's including all the uncertainties. And we can be very proud, actually, as scientists, to present not the rainforest will collapse by the year 2087. I'll tell you, this is the body of evidence. It's clumsy, it's cloudy, it is hazy, whatever. But millions of hours of work have gone into producing that hazy picture, actually. And we're very proud of presenting that, including all the uncertainties. So if climate skeptics are out to get you, tell them our best weapon is that we're truthful to uncertainty in the debate. I always encounter that the people who attack you are completely certain about their case. Whatever you tell them, they know 100% they are right. I don't know whether I'm right, at least not 100%. I'm a skeptic regarding my own work every day. You always scrutinize what you have done yesterday, and you're never confident. So that type of cloudiness, if you like, is precisely what the best level of science has to achieve. In 2005, and even worse, not so much noticed, the Amazon had a large drought. 2010 was worse than 2005. So we're seeing the writing on the wall already. This is a work I've done together with my colleague Hoffmann in Potsdam, which came as a surprise, actually. We tried to study ocean acidification and the effects on ecosystems and so on. What we discovered is actually, because of less export of particle ballast and so on, it's a complicated modeling exercise, you find what we call oxygen holes in the Pacific and so on. Because there will be almost oxygen-free regions between 200 and 800 meters because of shoaling, stratification, but also less export of particles into the deep sea. And that came as a big surprise. Now it has been taken up. So it is not just when I talk about the future of our oceans that they will rise high, they will warm up, they will turn sour, but we will also lose breath. And finally, if you take into account in a worst-case scenario, and again, this is just a scientific fiction so far, I talked about it at the Oxford conference, but meanwhile we have done some very serious work about it. Is there such a thing on Earth as a runaway greenhouse effect? We know such a thing is on Venus. Venus has embarked on a runaway greenhouse effect, so the average surface temperature 440 degrees centigrade, not 4 degrees centigrade, 440, the oceans have evaporated and so on, and you have a very CO2-thick atmosphere there. Can something like that ever happen on Earth? Of course, it will happen in 7 billion years from now, when the sun turns into a red giant. We can calculate this. Can it be triggered by humanity? I don't think so, but we may have discontinuities in the response of the Earth system to anthropogenic forcing. If you take into account, for example, the huge methane cleft rates on the ocean shelves, actually a very small fossil fuel stored there than in any other sources we have, coal, oil, everything combined. The other thing is the carbon which is stored in the Arctic soils, in particular methane, CO2, and so on. Now, we have embarked on a study together with Siberian colleagues who have the best data on that. How much is there in Siberia? It turns out that it's a lot, actually, and now I come back to the effect. Very simply put, the idea is that if you force the Earth system by an external perturbation to increase average temperature by, say, 2 degrees, and you release the system afterwards, will it sort of swing back? Of course, the overall temperature increase will be positive, so there will be an increase, but it may, through self-regulation, negative feedbacks, just go back by 1 degree or so on. Or will it self-amplify the perturbation, which what we call a positive feedback? Now, in general, you have a number of negative feedbacks. They are outlined here in green, and you have positive feedbacks. The most important of all the negative feedbacks, clearly, is the Stefan-Boltzmann radiative damping, which goes to the fourth power of global mean temperature. So it is, in the true sense of the word, very powerful, the fourth power, highly nonlinear. So if you increase the temperature of the Earth, then a lot gets lost by radiation into outer space, and there is a self-equilibration. But could we enter a situation where we switch the temperature artificially by a few degrees, and then the system decides to amplify that perturbation and just run away? For example, by releasing methane from the oceans or from the Arctic soils. And we did that type of calculation, and what we found is that if you take various scenarios, and it's a complicated, more or less to be understood by quantum physicists. So in my former life, I was a quantum physicist, and maybe some in the room have heard about energy bands in a solid. That is the basis for all the smart transistor technology and so on. We wouldn't sit here, I couldn't speak with the microphone, you wouldn't have a computer and so on, were it not for these energy gaps in the band structure of electrons in a solid, in a periodic system. And it seems that we find something like a temperature gap in our calculation. That means, according to the scenario, depending on the scenario we have, a certain temperature range cannot be sort of settled, if you like. So if we either have a warming, according to the feedback, which is something below 5 degrees or so on, or else it will be above 10 degrees. So this is very, very preliminary. If we can consolidate that, it is an almost mind-boggling result. But it simply would mean if you venture beyond a certain boundary, the system starts to self-amplify, a lot of positive feedback will kick in, and you simply cannot hold a temperature like 7 degrees above pre-industrial. Simply ruled out like certain energies in a solid. That is a fascinating scientific insight. It's less fascinating for humanity, I guess. Okay, let me conclude, more or less, yes. What can we do about it? Again, work by Malte Meinhausen, Miles Allen from Oxford and others have shown us a scientific way in order to calculate precisely what climate protection policy has to deliver globally. Now, if you take all the models together, you have a quasi-linear relationship between two entities. One is the expected global warming you get over the next 50 years or so on, and the other quantity you need to know simply is, and when it's a function of that, the cumulative emissions of greenhouse gases, in particular CO2. There's a quasi-linear relationship. In spite of all the non-linearities sort of dominating the Earth system, so you have carbon cycle, you have inertia in the ocean, but they all cancel more or less in order to provide you with a linear relationship. It makes things much easier, because if you tell me humankind will emit, say, 1,000 billion tons of CO2 over the next 40 years, I can calculate on the back of an envelope, or even without the back of an envelope, maybe even in my mind, I can calculate, which is, okay, don't want to comment on that. I can calculate the warming, the resulting warming. Now you can turn that around, and it's very powerful. You could simply say, if 194 nations said 2 degrees maximum warming, how much carbon credit are we left with globally? And This is, of course, a probability discussion. As I said, we have a lot of the haze of uncertainties and so on. If we want to hold the 2 degrees line with a 2 in 3 probability, which is not brilliant, in general, I comment this by saying if you play Russian roulette, you have a better chance. Actually, who played Russian roulette here before? It's so disappointing. Whenever I ask this question, nobody raises his or her arm. Although you have a 5 in 6 chance to survive, so you could play it at home. But this is not a scientific recommendation, by the way. Here it is. And that is what, in principle, the whole debate is all about. It is the critical decade we are living in now. If you assume we want to have a 2 in 3 chance to hold the 2 degrees line, avoiding all the strange encounters behind that fireball, which I sketched briefly, when we are left with about 750 gigatons of carbon dioxide between 2010 and 2050, over the next 40 years, the question is how to spend it. Now, this is global emissions profile. Now we are beyond the 30 gigatons already, 30 billion tons. And the question is how to spend now the remaining carbon budget. And it's an integral, of course. You know, the integral, the number is the area under the curve. Now, the curve can be bent in whatever way. You have a lot of flexibility. But the area always has to be the same. Now, 3 scenarios. If we would have peaking in global emissions, that means Copenhagen would have been a dramatic success. When we could follow that path here, you see a fairly mild phase-out of CO2. That means we spend the carbon budget this way. Something is still left in 2050. And the maximum reduction rate would be 3.7% per year, which is already a lot. If you wait just another 4 years, 2050, and that's the tyranny of the integral, if you like, what you overshoot here, you have to chip away afterwards. So we would have already about 1 Kyoto Protocol per year to deliver. 1 Kyoto Protocol fully established per year. But if we wait until 2020, and that's about the best and the most optimistic scenario, narrative of climate protection policy we can think of, when we would have reduction rates of about, at maximum, of 9% per year. Now, this is the task we challenge right now. Now, compare it to the carbon tax here in Australia. I think 5% reduction in 2020 as compared to 2005, that's insignificant. It does not mean it's not a necessary measure, by the way. Anyway, so we did a lot of calculations. In the end, it simply means how would you spend the carbon credit with nature among the nations of the world? And so we did, apart from this very sobering exercise, 750 gigatons left, how do you spend it over the next years? And I showed you sort of peaking of emissions is absolutely crucial before 2020. But the other thing is the question of justice. This simply means if you distribute the budget, the integral, so to speak, over all nations of the world on an equal per capita basis. Simply means every person, every man, every woman, in the future at least, has the same right to use the atmosphere. Sounds logical, I think. I think Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, was the first one to introduce this as a general principle of justice. So I talked to the German chancellor about it. She knows Kant very well. You always have to start with a philosopher if you talk to politicians, you know. And then you end up with physics. And so, she is actually a believer in that. She even renewed that at a conference we had a week ago. If you distribute it on an equal per capita basis, then, of course, this means what it means for the various countries of the world, because it means you have to go down in your per capita emissions radically. By the way, the area under the curve, so this is black for the United States of America, these are per capita emissions. If you distribute it according to an overall justice principle, blue is Germany, the areas under the curve are always the same. Everybody has to spend the same carbon budget, but you can choose how to do it. And it would mean, according to that scheme, the U.S. would be carbon bankrupt in the year 2020. India could go on almost forever. Burkina Faso has not even started to emit. But these are the countries who will see the most severe impacts, clearly. I mean, this is not doable. We all know that. I mean, when I presented this to some members of Obama's administration, several ministers included, and so on, you can imagine how the reaction was. At least I was allowed to leave the country. I had a narrow escape, though. But, of course, the general comment, actually even from journalists, was, well, the U.S. Senate will never approve of that. So that was the reaction. Of course, the U.S. Senate will never approve of that. What you could do, and that relates to Australia's debate, understand that you are not introducing a carbon tax as such, but you are introducing an emissions trading system in the long run. A flexible economic instrument, which is, of course, much favorable. And what we did is calculating here, if you distribute this carbon credit among the three blocks of nations, you know, the industrialized countries in red, the emerging economies like China in yellow, and the developing countries, including India in this case, when you would have these decarbonization curves. But if you include now a trading of emissions, it's a bit complicated, but just focus on the solid lines, which more or less converge towards 2050. It means if you would trade about 140 gigatons of carbon from allowances, actually, from India to the United States and so on, when we could all converge to the same per capita emissions in 2050. So it's doable, and we calculated what it would cost. It costs about 100 billion U.S. dollar per year transfer from south to north, which sounds absolutely fair. It's almost nothing compared to the global GDP, for example. So it can be done if you are willing to let the market unroll and unfold its forces. The funny thing is that if you talk to market liberals, they are the strongest opponents to that in general. Huh? Very strange, but I'm a plain, simple physicist. I cannot understand that. Finally, because I'm coming from Germany now. Now in Germany, something very strange happened. The minister, actually the government, was embarking on an extension of lifetime for nuclear energy. We have 17 nuclear power plants. And after Fukushima, complete U-turn happened. And it was pledged that there will be a phase-out of nuclear power plants by 2022 without giving up our climate goals. That means 40% reduction of CO2 emissions or carbon emissions as compared to 1990 levels by 2020. 40%. That is quite dramatic. And that can only be achieved if you give up on nuclear and at the same time you honor your climate pledges, if you have an aggressive buildup of renewable energies and much higher energy efficiency standards. So, the ballpark numbers are, by 2050, Germany wants to cut its primary energy consumption in half. Although we are an industrialized country and number two in export values in the world and so on. And 80% of the electricity has to come from renewables by then. So you see here on this chart simply how the narrative goes. On the left-hand side, 2010, you have the old energy system, coal and oil and so on, and it turns colorful without the brownish parts of it in 2050 here. It all can be done. We did the physical and chemical and engineering calculations. It all can be done. It comes with extra costs of maybe 10 euro per household a month. But many people think this is too costly to save the planet. Thank you very much.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and we have time to squeeze in just a bit more from Professor John Schellenhuber from the 4 Degrees or More conference in Melbourne, Australia. From the audience, someone asked whether there is hope for Australia or the world climate.
The bottom line is the challenge, the physical challenge of climate change we're facing is really probably the biggest of the 21st century. I tried to underpin this statement with a number of charts and assessments. On the other hand, our innovation potential is also unprecedented in the 21st century. Yeah? It will be a race between what we're doing to the environment and how we unleash the forces of innovation, actually. And it seems if you take it all together, then we have a fair chance, actually, to still solve the problem, at least in a regional context. And if Germany is embarking, using, of course, wind energy, photovoltaics, solar thermal, and so on, geothermal, on completely transforming its energy system, I think Australia is actually in a much, much better situation to do that. If you fly across this country, I mean, 95% of the area is unused in any way. I mean, you have it's bathed in sunshine all the time. For me, it's, and actually everybody outside Australia, it's unbelievable that solar energy doesn't play a much bigger role here. Huh? And of course, I know that selling coal to China and so on seems to be a safe bet for the future, but one shouldn't be too sure about that bet, because I know the Chinese pretty well. I talked to many of the top officials. You should not depend on the dependence of others, actually. Yeah? That is a fairly stupid strategy, because, of course, China does not want to import coal forever from Australia. First of all, we have a lot of coal in their own grounds, actually. It's simply too expensive to ship it, actually, from the western part to the eastern part. It's cheaper to have it shipped from Brisbane or wherever. That's the logic of economics, but that will change in the future. And also we have a massive program to go into renewables. So 17 Chinese ministers came to visit Germany 2 weeks ago. We had a joint cabinet meeting, one of the big issues, so that happened for the first time. And the Chinese have never done that before to any country. It was all about innovation in the energy mix and so on. And we call it the emergence of a fitness club for the 21st century, with just two members here, Germany and China. Why shouldn't Australia become the third member? It would be fairly easy to do so.
That was Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, also known as John. The speech was titled Strange Encounters Behind the 2 Degrees Firewall. It was a keynote presentation for experts at the conference 4 Degrees or More in Melbourne, Australia in July 2011. You can find all the conference speeches, including two important videos, at the website 4degrees2011.com.au. I filled half a binder with notes from this Australian conference. Help yourself at 4degrees2011.com.au. We all need to go back to school to learn and then pass it on to teach others to tell our neighbors while there is still time to save our climate. And there is still time if we can make a miracle, if we can change. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We are out of time for this week. Find more notes on John Schellenhuber and the conference in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Download all our past programs, including many interviews with top climate scientists, at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for being brave enough to listen. Tune in next week.
Radio EcoShock.